I understand that at the start of this day, Ambassador Shankar said that infrastructure is one of the three major challenges facing India over the next several decades. And from our perspective at the Brookings Metropolitan Program, which focuses on cities and metropolitan areas in the United States, clearly that infrastructure challenge relates not just to growth in general, but to the rapid urbanization of India. I know that some of these statistics may have been mentioned before, but from an American perspective, they're just simply astounding. The McKinsey Global Institute report from last year said that over 590 million people will live in India's cities by 2030. That's twice the population of the United States. 68 cities will have a population over a million by 2030 compared to 42 cities today. That's going to require, as you can imagine, an enormous amount of infrastructure building across many different dimensions. The McKinsey report also projected 700 and 900 million square meters of commercial and residential space will be need to be built, the equivalent of a new Chicago every year for those of us from the Windy City. 2.5 million square meters of roads will need to be paved, about 20 times the capacity added in the past decade, and 7,400 kilometers of metros and subways will need to be built, also 20 times the capacity added in the past decade. So this is just a vast dimension of infrastructure needs given current capacity. So what we're going to do in this panel is explore the potential financing mechanisms that could be implemented to help India close what is an enormous infrastructure gap, and how the United States firms, companies, intermediaries, government can participate in that process. Before we get to that panel, it's my pleasure to introduce the Secretary of the Department of Economic Affairs in India's Ministry of Finance, R. Gopalan, who will provide the keynote for this panel. He previously served as Secretary of the Department of Financial Services in the Ministry of Finance, where he was in charge of banking, insurance, and pension reforms. And prior to that, he was Special Secretary in the Department of Commerce and held other key assignments. So, Mr. Secretary.
Ladies and gentlemen, you all know that India has emerged as one of the fastest growing economies during the past decade. However, infrastructure development has not kept pace with the growth in the rest of the country. Till 2007, India was spending only 5% of its gross domestic product on infrastructure. Our road network is not adequately strengthened. National highways, which account for 40% of the traffic, have only 17% four-lane roads, while 53% are two-laned and 30% are single-laned. Our ports have inadequate berths. Railroad connectivity is deficient. Power sector still suffers from 14% peaking deficit and 11% energy shortage, coupled with a colossal loss of 27% on account of transmission and distribution, which is primarily on account of leakages. There is absence of competition and inadequate private investment in the private in the power sector. We did manage to raise the level of infrastructure investment during the past few years, and as per the latest data available, the investment between 2007 and 2010 was $266 billion, and estimated to increase to about $500 billion by FY 2012. The share of GDP going into infrastructure investment has increased from 5% in 2007 to 7% in 2009-10, and estimated to increase to 8.37% in 2011-12. Private investment, which contributed to 25% of infrastructure investment during 2007, has increased its share to 34% in 2008-9, and is expected to increase further to 39% by 2011-12. Looking at the sector-wise performance, the growth in the telecom sector during the current five-year plan has been phenomenal, and the investment is expected to be $86 billion, which is 34% higher than the initial estimates. The investment in power sector was $29 billion in 2008-09 and is expected to reach $40 billion in 2011-12. For the period 2012-17, however, assuming an annual 9% growth of GDP, it's estimated that about 10% of GDP would need to be for infrastructure investment. On this basis, the estimated investment for this period is $1 trillion, and given the constraint on public funding, 50% of this would need to be funded by private investment. So, new avenues for financing and adopting innovative approaches to financing for infrastructure need, infrastructure requirements are the ones which we need to pursue. Public-private partnerships and private investment, however feasible, become the thrust areas. Thus, sectors like airlines, telecom, and power generation witness significant private investment, whereas in other sectors like highways, ports, airports, PPPs were the preferred mode. Our PPP program has been hailed as a success story. As on date, around 700 PPP projects with a project cost of US$84.85 billion are under implementation or at an advanced stage of bidding. For financing PPP projects, the government has relied on levy of user fees and mobilization of funds by the private sector. However, given the constraints on increasing the user fee beyond a certain reasonable level, there was a need to have in place alternate source of funding to bridge the financing gap in individual projects. The viability gap funding scheme was devised to address this issue. The scheme aimed at providing upfront capital grant to PPP projects to enable financing of commercially unviable projects. The level of grant was the net present value of the gap between the project cost and the estimated revenue generation over the concession period based on a user fee that was to be levied in a predetermined manner. The grant was to be the bidding parameter, and thus the competitive market forces were being relied upon to arrive at the financial support required from the government. The scheme provided that maximum level of grant permissible would be 40% and projects seeking higher level of grant required restructuring. As on date, 81 projects with a capital cost of about $12 billion have been approved for grant support. Availability of long-term debt was identified as an area of concern. India Infrastructure Finance Company, IIFCL, was established with a mandate to raise funds against sovereign guarantee and on-lend long-tenure debt to infrastructure projects. IFCL has been providing 20% of the total project cost as long-tenure debt to PPP projects, thus reducing the need for financing by commercial banks. In addition to direct lending, IFCL is also undertaking refinance of projects. As on date, 176 projects have been sanctioned for refinance for almost $8 billion. As PPP projects are implemented by special purpose vehicles, credit enhancement is crucial for their financeability. Government policy was to develop a self-sustaining mechanism to provide inbuilt credit enhancement mechanism for PPP projects. Thus, contracts for PPP projects were standardized towards ensuring transparency and predictability of the underlying payment mechanism. Model concession agreements for different sectors duly approved by the competent authorities formed part of the bidding process. The model concession agreements addressed various lender issues of PPP projects, like mandating an escrow mechanism, providing substitution rights for lenders, buyback guarantees in the event of termination, etc. To accelerate the flow of funds, offshore funds, foreign investors who meet with the KYC guidelines have been allowed to invest directly in the Indian mutual funds. Along with this, guidelines have been issued on Monday, that is yesterday in India. Along with this, in two stages, the ceiling for investments by FIAs into corporate bonds have been announced considerably from the existing US $15 billion to US $40 billion, the additional limit being available for bond offerings of more than five-year residual maturity of infrastructure companies, whether listed or unlisted. Though this enhancement also carries lock-in of 3 years, it is nevertheless permitted to be traded as such, and this should be of interest to FIAs in increasing their India commitment. Of the total investment during 2007-10, 50% is from budgetary sources, 30% is from debt funding, and the remaining from private equity. Commercial banks have contributed 20% of the total debt funding, and the remaining 16% has together been contributed by NBFCs, ECBs, and insurance companies. The total bank lending to infrastructure went up from 8.68% of total bank credit as at the end of March 2008 to 14.7% by end March 2011. Thus, the major part of debt requirements of infrastructure sector in India continues to be sourced through commercial banks. The fundamental financing constraint going forward relates to inadequate availability of long-tenor debt, mainly because of the bank's asset-liability mismatch and concentration risks. Increasingly, therefore, there is a need to rely upon intermediating greater flows of insurance and pension funds into infrastructure, subject, of course, to the overriding concern of safeguarding the interests of the policyholders and the pensioners. From 2012 to 2017, a shortfall of $200 billion is estimated to be the gap in financing, primarily on the debt side. To meet the challenges in coming years, we need to develop alternate sources of funding besides bank lending. Towards this end, we would need to further strengthen the corporate bond market and develop credit enhancement mechanisms which will enable infrastructure projects to access long-tenor funds available with domestic and foreign pension and insurance funds. We would also have to consider suitable regulatory changes for channelizing greater amounts of foreign capital, especially debt capital, into Indian infrastructure. The first step taken towards this end was the Infrastructure Debt Fund, or IDF, as we call, to accelerate and enhance the flow of long-term debt in infrastructure projects. A scheme for the Infrastructure Debt Fund has been announced last Friday, and it is available in the public domain. To attract the offshore funds into IDFs, the Finance Minister has also announced the withholding tax on interest payments on borrowings by IDFs would be reduced from 20% to 5%. Income of the IDF has been exempted from income tax. In our attempt to cover different classes of investors, IDFs have been allowed to be set up as trusts or mutual funds, which would issue units, and as companies, which would issue bonds. In case of an IDF that issues bonds, the credit enhancement inherent in the PPP projects would become available. Such IDFs would refinance PPP projects after their construction is completed and they have successfully operated for at least 1 year. These projects would involve a lower level of risk and consequently a higher credit rating. Such a structure would enable flow of insurance and pension funds at competitive costs in order to channelize low-cost long-term debt in PPP projects in infrastructure sectors such as roads, ports, airports, railways, and metro rail, etc. In case of IDFs that issue units, which is the mutual fund route, greater credit risks would be borne by the investors themselves, who will be free to seek correspondingly higher returns. Mutual funds would especially be useful for non-PPP projects. To further build up our PPP program, there is a need to scale upon our past initiatives. Our endeavor is to come up with a comprehensive PPP policy that can be used by the center and the state governments in further developing PPPs. The success of the viability gap funding scheme has prompted the government to include crucial sectors like education, health, cold storage within its ambit. IFCL, which performed an important role in providing niche long-term funding to infrastructure projects, is now graduating to the next phase of project financing. We are undertaking schemes aimed at credit enhancement to project bonds, thereby facilitating investment by a large number of institutional long-term investors. Government have aimed increasing the share of manufacturing in GDP from the present level of 16% to 25% within 10 years. A national manufacturing policy which is under finalization proposes creation of national investment and manufacturing zones as mega investment regions equipped with world-class infrastructure, and this would also be eligible for a number of benefits. The other area requiring urgent action is funding of urban infrastructure. Urban local bodies, or ULBs in India, are regarded as weak, both in terms of capacity to raise resources and in financing autonomy. Their precarious state of finances, as well as their complex institutional and fiscal framework, hampers their ability to access debt markets. There is an urgent need to strengthen the resource base of ULBs, which would enable them to leverage the same to incur debt and also access new forms of financing through issue of bonds or undertaking PPP projects. Providing the municipalities access to the debt market would require that municipalities become credit worthy. India's municipal bond market is severely underdeveloped, with only around 15 to 20 municipal bond issuances aggregating to just around $2.5 billion so far, which comprises a minuscule proportion of the Indian bond market. To develop the municipal bond market, issuer and investor base would need to be broadened, secondary market activity strengthened, and ULBs made subject to credit ratings. Credit enhancement mechanism need to be put in place to make these bonds achieve the desired level of risk by the investors. To allow the ULBs to access municipal debt market, we need to streamline devolution of funds to ULBs, enable escrowing of these funds devolved, mandate accounting on accrual basis, provide government grants by way of viability gap funding, both for capital and operating expenditure, seamless development of bond market, and credible provisions mandating levy of user fee. Indian infrastructure today represents an investment opportunity which the global financial community cannot afford to miss. The extent of foreign participation, both through debt and equity, in the financing of India's infrastructure has been of order of about 8 to 10% in the recent past. I expect going forward a much greater degree of involvement of foreign investors in this sector. I am aware that there are issues such as land acquisition, environmental clearances, and rehabilitation of displaced persons, which cause concern on account of their potential to introduce time and cost overruns in otherwise attractive project propositions. However, let me assure this gathering that there is a sustained and continuous policy churn which is happening in these areas with a view to resolving the remaining impediments. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
That provided the right framework for this, both in terms of the broad gap and the need, but also what is an array of policy initiatives to open up and free up capital. What we have here is, I think, an excellent panel. I'm going to introduce the whole panel, and then I'm going to go from my right to the left and have everyone make introductory comments of, let's say, 4 or 5 minutes. So I think everyone has the packet here, so you've got the full bios. So I'll give very brief introductions, and you can look in the packet for some deeper information. To my right at the far end is Ajit Gulabchand, the chairman and managing director of Hindustan Construction Company, obviously one of India's largest construction companies. I found it very interesting in the bio, and we just talked about this, of your involvement in the build-out of a new city, Lavasa, 300,000 people ultimately. Very interesting from the perspective of a new build in infrastructure. To his left, Aaron Klein, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy Coordination at the U.S. Department of Treasury, overseeing regulatory reform, infrastructure finance, housing finance. Those of us in the United States know Aaron very well for his work on the infrastructure bank concept, which hopefully is making some progress through the Congress. To my left, first, Rajiv Lal, Managing Director, CEO of the Infrastructure Development Finance Company, Steering Committee on Urban Development, the management, a member of the G20 work group on infrastructure, a long history in this area. Warburg Pincus, Morgan Stanley, Asian Development Bank, World Bank. That's quite a resume, actually. To his left, Naresh Thakkar, Managing Director, CEO of ICRA Limited, well-known, I'm sure, in this group, one of India's premier credit rating agencies, an associate of Moody's. And finally, Nasser Malik from Citigroup Global, very involved in infrastructure finance at the global level. Ajit, can you start?
Well, I think the enormity of India's infrastructure requirement has been very well outlined, and so has its deficit. That itself tells you what India really needs to do. The issues that confront and the challenges that confront India are the ones that how are we actually going to make this happen? And how do we look at new ways of financing? But before we get down to new ways of financing, there's a lot of basics that need to be addressed, which itself will improve the investment climate into infrastructure. I think Secretary Gopalan has done an excellent job in outlining both the challenges and very optimistically set out an agenda to address them. And I must say that it does an excellent job in doing that. What we find in India is a variety of issues like land acquisition, which is needed from point of view of eminent domain to build several of the infrastructure projects, to acquire more land from agriculturists in order to be able to provide for new urban centers and new industries to come up, as well as there are several issues of policy like the environment regulations, which are quite arbitrarily implemented at the present moment, do not have any objective and measurable standards that industry can easily follow or know about. So there are several such changes that need to be carried out so that you can create a certain amount of certainty in what you can expect from the administration in implementing their policies. There is also another issue that we can confront from time to time, is that the concession agreements that are drawn up for private sector participation in public-private partnerships often are somewhat flawed, which give problems from point of view of the lenders as well as from point of view of the investors. And therefore, what you really see here is a number of things that create uncertainty and therefore increase risk in investment. Now, if we can address some of these issues to begin with, I think we will go a long way in creating the foundation for all kinds of new instruments to come in to be able to finance. One of the important things that is missing in India is project finance. There is no such thing as project finance. All the funding is done with some recourse to the sponsors, some recourse to the promoters. It is never limited to the project. And as a result, balance sheets of many, many companies cannot afford to make those investments. Concession agreements do not allow you to exit on time early enough. And of course, there's another kind of infrastructure necessary to make that happen more easily. But nevertheless, it's not allowed to, and therefore does not release the money for reinvesting in other and newer infrastructure projects. So we have here a number of things that are put back on the balance sheets of companies that are interested in investing in new. There is no dearth of entrepreneurship willing to come forth in order to do that, as again Secretary Gopalan outlined as to the success side of it. India's infrastructure is a great story on one side of grand success and on the other side of utter failure. So when you look at this, when you can bring in project finance, I think you will improve considerably the funding that can be made for infrastructure projects. There's also the question of not having long-term debt. Most of the long-term debt in our country is entirely on a way of funding called takeout financing, which means at the end of a short period of 5 years, somebody promises to make sure that he will take on the debt from there onwards. Plus, it is substantially dependent on banking, which then cannot exit the whole debt that they have taken on themselves. Now, in order to do that, you will need to create bonds, which, again, we welcome the step that the government is now moving towards that in a fast manner. I hope we can fast-track it to be able to create that. But before we do that, it is also necessary for us to see that the government, which is one of the biggest raisers of debt in the country, is also managed a little better. Today, it is the Reserve Bank of India is also the investment banker to the government. So there's a small conflict of interest here, that instead of curtailing the government from accessing the market excessively, it actually participates in it because it earns from it to be able to make more bonds, crowding out private sector. So I think creating the Office of Debt Management is also going to help considerably to be able to create a solid debt market in the country. And with this debt market, project financing and removing all the obstacles of policy uncertainties, implementation of policy in an arbitrary manner, I think we will go a long way in finding that deficit. So what really we have is a governance deficit that is not allowing the infrastructure deficit to grow as it should be. And challenges are immense. Of course, you are talking of an emerging market, and you are talking of an immense, huge market that has to cater to its huge population in a very short time. It also has an structural deficit of not having sufficient local self-governance with accountability to its citizens so that urban development can take place in this fashion. So municipal bonds can become an actual market in India. It's not just because it's not been adequately tapped, but there are no accountable mayors in this country to be able to do that. So with all this, and I'm glad to hear from Secretary Gopalan that they are addressing this, but without addressing the fundamental issues, we won't be able to even get to innovative financing.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank the Confederation of Indian Industries and Brookings for hosting us all here today and for inviting me. I want to speak a little bit briefly about what we found at Treasury about the economics of investment in infrastructure and different ways to think about infrastructure investment and finance. First, I want to talk a little bit about the need for strategic investment on the basis of kind of a total benefit versus cost framework. This includes measuring social benefits or externalities, as they're frequently referred to in economics, which is very difficult. But it's incredibly important because just costs are somewhat easier to measure with the respect of project finance. Now, you can have cost overruns and you have cost variance for sure. But at the end of the day, measuring total outflows is far easier than measuring the total benefits, especially with, by their nature, infrastructure projects tend to have larger, broader benefits, social benefits, benefits that even accrue to non-users of the infrastructure itself. But if you don't fully analyze those benefits equally across different modes or kinds of infrastructure, you can skew your investment decisions. So I'd start by advocating for that type of cost-benefit analysis, and then once you've developed the right framework, to applying it in a cross-sector approach. Then that leads to the question of how you want to finance it. Ideally, you'd want to have a beneficiary finance system where the beneficiaries of the infrastructure pay. The problem there is, as I said earlier, when the beneficiaries are the non-users. So you can imagine a scenario about toll roads, for example, where clearly those who drive are the users and they pay. However, then you can imagine the people that for whom traffic is alleviated, who are not on the toll road but the road next to it, they are in some ways benefiting from the same investment. There should be some sort of amount of payment on that side. It's very difficult, and I'm not advocating to try and capture that on a granular level. I will say that the American experience, we've seen a wide variety of different funding streams to try and capture different aspects of this, from the user fee position to the special land value or special tax district capturing, all the way to general sales tax revenue, which finance a fair amount of infrastructure at the state and local level, which in some ways is the broadest measurement of local economic activity, which may skew more towards capturing value from non-beneficiaries than direct beneficiaries of the project, but in some way captures the broadest range of economic development from infrastructure. So I think that you want to think about those different approaches to financing out of beneficiaries and try and match, depending again on the type of infrastructure investment, as best you can. Next, I want to touch briefly on the difference between maintenance and new construction. Ned Gramlich, before he went on to have a very distinguished career at the Federal Reserve as one of the governors, did some research in this as an economist, and he found a tremendous value in terms of return on investment to bringing existing infrastructure up to a state of good repair. Interestingly, he found very little value from going beyond a state of good repair and basic maintenance to a state of excellence. But there can often be political or other pressures to build new infrastructure, neglecting existing infrastructure. And that, on the same economic basis of cost-benefit, can really miss the boat. You want to include questions of maintenance and looking at your existing infrastructure, as Gramlich found. Secondarily, as I said earlier, you want to look at this in a multimodal sector. This can be difficult, especially as you extend beyond just different modes of transportation, but into different water or energy, schools or other types of public buildings. But if you've thought through the broadest questions of social benefits, some modes may provide more or less than others, and depending on policymakers' preferences at various levels, you may want to weight things differently. But you should be able to be comfortable with a framework that captures as broad a set as possible. That brings my second to last point regarding the network effects. One of the things that's unique about infrastructure is it inherently creates network externalities. In the U.S., an economist, John Fernault, did some research on the effects of building our interstate highway system, which is a very elaborate network, which has tremendous value, and he said it had huge value in improving total factor productivity in various sectors of our economy that rely on transportation. He said you got a huge benefit from completing this network as we did in the 50s and 60s. Building a second network probably wouldn't see that benefit. So you have to weigh the value of building and connecting your existing networks without creating duplicativity and duplicating networks. The corollary of that is integrating various networks and avoiding too siloed of an approach. I think one thing that we can learn from in America from our funding of investment in infrastructure for a variety of reasons, we've tended to disincentivize investment in interconnecting networks. That can be networks of various modes of infrastructure. It can be networks across state or local jurisdictional lines where you have natural dividers within a network. But there's a lot of value to be had between interacting and connecting networks. And again, with the right type of framework of looking at total value benefit capture, irrespective of the mode, along with a somewhat mode neutral or non-siloed approach to financing from an incentive based on the federal level, that will help kind of, I think, bridge some of those gaps. Here in the U.S., we're looking, as Bruce alluded to establishing a national infrastructure bank to catalyze greater investment here in American infrastructure, precisely along some of those types of areas of multimodal, multi-jurisdictional, and multi-network areas that I mentioned earlier. And I hope that experience and insight from the American experience is useful to our counterparts in India. Thank you.
So that's great, Aaron. I think we could spend an entire forum of lessons of what not to do out of the American experience. That's the next conference. Rajiv.
Thanks. Well, actually, it's, I'll start with your last observation about what not to do. The reality is that living in internet time and living day to day in the Indian context, the sheer scale of actions on the ground and challenges to meet is such that we are learning every day. I don't think we have the answers, but over time, if you reflect on what's happened in the infrastructure space over the last 10 years, those learnings have incrementally been incorporated, but there is still a very long road ahead. I want to make 5 points around this theme. The first is learning about financial engineering. I think Secretary Gopalan laid out the challenges very clearly, which is to say that we have to rely for a variety of reasons on a very aggressive participation of the private sector in order to reach our goals in the infrastructure build-out. Inviting the private sector to actually develop infrastructure raises some very special problems. I mean, there's all the literature and the controversy, which we live day to day, on sharing of risks between public and private. But beyond that, there are also tensions between short-term and long-term. All those need to be resolved. Financing of private infrastructure is much harder than financing public infrastructure because budgetary financing is quite easy to do in a financial engineering sense. There's nothing much to be done. But financing private projects with some public good characteristics to them raises very, very difficult and challenging issues. But in a nutshell, the broad issue that the challenge that we face is that the bulk of our very substantial savings, which are growing as a share of GDP, 34-35%, are in forms that do not lend themselves to long-term intermediation. So whereas infrastructure requires really long-term financing. So how do we change the institutional piping of our financial architecture in a timely manner, that we can better utilize our existing savings into financing infrastructure is the challenge. Eventually, we will be able to do it, but the financing requirement is here and now. Right? We are already, so what is the alternative? If domestically those sources of long-term financing, albeit growing, are still not up to the scale requirements, do we turn to foreign financing? And if we turn to foreign financing, do we want to expand the size of our current account deficit? We have, you know, government officials and the RBI sitting here. I think 3% of GDP is probably reaching the limits of our comfort zone. So then we have to figure out ways of better channeling foreign resources that are currently coming into India, make their channeling into infrastructure relatively more attractive. So that's the nature of the challenge. On the positive side, what I would say is that because of the sheer scale of opportunities in India, there is actually room for very constructive financial engineering in this regard. And what that means is that whereas greenfield risk is not something that foreign debt financiers would very readily finance, right? Cash-generating infrastructure with lower risk characteristics is something that they may be more open to. So the infrastructure debt fund that Secretary Gopalan talked about is actually a very, very important step in that direction, creating a vehicle that allows the domestic financial system, the banks primarily, to focus on financing greenfield infrastructure, then translating or relaying that risk into special purpose vehicles that aggregate or pool risk across a variety and range of projects that are cash generating infrastructure and invite on a risk mitigated manner foreign capital. What we don't know today is whether, even having done that, do we still need additional credit enhancement? And that is something that will be put to the commercial test. But I have a very specific suggestion in that nature, and I think in that direction, which I think would be fruitful discussions for cooperation, which could actually be G2G. If some kind of quasi-sovereign support to entities like OPIC, for example, in this country, could be directed towards providing targeted credit enhancement for Indian infrastructure, the U.S., theoretically, could play a vital role in helping us develop, let's say, green infrastructure, which would, you know, be to the common good, sit well in the context of bilateral discussions, but be a very appropriate use, if you like, of this platform of G2G consultation. Very quickly, a couple of other points. As we learn how to deal with the participation of the private sector, there are three lessons, I think, that are now bubbling up for all of us to consider. The first, we've always known it theoretically, but now we see it day to day, is the critical importance of policy predictability. And I'll give you a very simple example in the case of power. The most important decision that was made in the power sector was over a decade and a half ago, when we unbundled the electricity supply chain, distribution, transmission to generation. Generation was opened for private participation. Now, we have billions of dollars that have gone into investment into generation assets, but distribution is still controlled by the public sector. And you now have a mismatch that is developing between distribution companies that are not able to raise user charges and tariffs, and they are procuring power increasingly at market-determined rates delivered by private generators. So that is creating uncertainty and infirmity in the supply chain, which needs to be tackled now before it gets out of hand. There are many examples of predictability, to go back to Ajit's point about environmental regulations and their applications, but the importance of that to maintain the confidence of private investors is absolutely key. Second learning is about policy coordination. I think we have gotten much better at policy coordination, but India is not alone in this experience. The reality is that government decision-making is balkanized, but it needs much greater coordination. I'll give you, again, a simple example. The definition of what is infrastructure is not consistent across different arms of government. So for tax benefits, there is a particular definition. Secretary Gopalan talked about education and healthcare being an important area for infrastructure development to incentivize Indian investors and foreign investors to enter that space. However, the Reserve Bank of India does not consider education and healthcare as infrastructure. So those of us who are trying to finance those sectors get tied up in knots, if you see what I mean. That's on policy coordination. Last point is on when you look at the next decade, your point about urbanization. This is a huge challenge for us. We haven't even begun to scratch the surface of what needs to be done. But municipal finance, in my personal opinion, is going to be much more challenging in India, precisely because of the infirmity of municipal-level financing. Perhaps a much more robust model for India would be to help support the development of multi-city corporations that provide certain services. That, with a robust policy on user charges, may actually make those entities much more financeable. That's one. The second thing that we need to think about much harder is how do we unlock the value of land? There's a huge amount of land, actually, that is available within various government departments, which will accrete in its value as urbanization takes place. We have to find a mechanism to capture that value so that it can be redeployed into municipal infrastructure. I'll stop there.
Very helpful. Naresh.
Thank you. I think some of the earlier speakers have made excellent points relating to addressing the policy-related issues, structural-related issues, and also the uncertainties which undermine investments in the sector. Just to endorse that, I think financing possibly is lesser of a challenge, though it is a challenge talking about the scale of financing which is required for the Indian infrastructure sector. However, the structural issues which undermine the commercial viability and add to the uncertainty.
We may need the volume up on the mic. Okay.
So unless the policy-related issues and the structural issues which undermine commercial viability and add to the uncertainty to the sector, are addressed, I think really achieving scalability in the financing would become a meaningless exercise unless we address the core issues. We talked about issues which relate to land acquisition, relating to regulatory uncertainties. We in the past used to believe that it's really the construction phase which is the most critical phase and the in terms of the riskiness of the projects. And as projects achieve or get implemented, the risk indeed do come down. While it does happen in most projects, but as we are talking about higher scales, and particularly if I may take the example of power sector, and Rajiv also highlighted the issues there, you know, the kind of the fact that we have a distribution system which is largely state-owned. And even where in the cities where there has been experimentation in terms of privatization of the distribution setup, the way the regulatory framework in terms of the tariff determination has worked, we have a huge issue of the tariff inadequacy resulting in the cost of supply being much higher than the cost of the actual realizations from those sources. So these issues have to be addressed if, let's say, we need to have a viable solution for finding financing options for the infrastructure. Moving forward, saying that these issues need to be addressed, Second, in terms of the financing requirements, particularly as Rajiv also mentioned, the long-term financing indeed is a big challenge in India. We talk about a large percentage of savings in the system, which indeed is, I think, a great strength for the Indian economy. But within that, about one-third of the total savings which we have really go into physical assets, which are not really directly available for any form of financial intermediation. Part of that, when we talk about physical infrastructure, large part of that investment also goes into investments in gold, for example, which is very peculiar in the Indian system. A lot of investors have a lot of faith in gold, possibly now being shared by a lot of global investors. We believe there was some talk some time back tapping this form of investment whereby some investment scheme which mirrors the underlying gold kind of returns and also enables these investors to get the benefit of the security of the underlying gold value. We believe that kind of a structure possibility should be considered, and there may be a huge amount of scope in terms of creating financial intermediation of these physical related investments in the system. We talked about development of long-term capital, long-term domestic bond market, local currency bond market. I would not go into the issues. Everybody is aware of the concerns and the issues which are there. But needless to add, insurance worldwide and pension funds have been largely instrumental in providing long-term liabilities. Banks, which are largely funding these requirements, do not have the liability structure. However, as Mr. Gopalan rightly said, to subject insurance policyholders and the pension policyholders to be subjected to higher amount of risk would also not be right unless we address the basic risk which exists in the infrastructure sector. However, I do believe that there may be a merit in imposing the way we do it in the banks. There may be a merit in terms of imposing some kind of a capital adequacy requirements for in relation to the risk which these insurance companies take on, rather than just creating a binary kind of a situation where either you have a AA and above rating and also the discretionary element which is allowed to the insurance companies is rather limited. So if there is adequate capital, possibly the risks which these insurance companies are subjected to can be addressed. However, insurance companies do have limited access to capital. There are restrictions in terms of shareholding, etc., which possibly is another subject. Then, clearly, even if we add up all forms of financing, international financing is, I think, going to be very critical for funding the requirements. Still, there are there have been a lot of policy related issues which have been addressed. However, there are still restrictions in terms of not allowing external commercial borrowings for example, refinancing of the projects. Now, as Rajiv pointed out, it's very difficult to have a foreign investor looking at the initial construction risk as a viable option. Really, when the projects are operational, refinancing is something which any foreign investor possibly would be looking at, but that's something which current policies do not allow. And on top of that, we do have restrictions still on the amount of spread which an external, if you need to raise external funds, there are caps on the amount of spread which you can pay, which again needs to be possibly left to the market forces, because the way the market sees the risk, they would like to see what kind of spread they need to charge for such investments. Moving on to some issues relating to structuring of instruments, very clearly, I don't see much scope in terms of having a complete non-recourse kind of a structure. But I think the innovation really would be how to reduce or have some kind of a limited form of recourse, which could be limited for the tenure, which could be restricted to the critical construction phase, where clearly, in case those projects have lower operational risk. Second, it could be limited only to part of the amount, which could mean credit enhancement of the risk to a level which is acceptable to the investors. The government has a scheme which is through the grants for the viability financing, which is clearly in that direction. Then learning from how banks have been very successful in India, and which is something which is a challenge, and I've not seen it happening in any other market, which is to have some kind of a flexible maturity and flexible repayment term for a bond kind of an instrument. Commercial banks, why they are very successful also in infrastructure financing, besides various other benefits which they have, is also because the fact that they are very flexible in terms of restructuring their terms when they see that the project is experiencing some slippages. Good thing about infrastructure projects in a supply-constrained economy like India is that there may be issues which may result in point-in-time default. However, the expected loss or the ultimate recoverability of those amounts invested can be very large. So if some structure whereby some kind of a contingent liquidity support could be provided, whereby such kind of defaults, which are very critical from a market access perspective, could be provided for. And at the same time, there may be some kind of a inbuilt flexible structure whereby in case the project is experiencing a delay, it could be accommodated in that kind of a structure. Also, a portfolio-based approach, I think that's something which provides better diversity and does reduce the risk, is something which could certainly be something which can be expanded on. And there could be various forms of time tranching of instruments which could be done to meet maturity expectations of different type of investors, and also various forms of senior, subordinated, and mezzanine kind of structures which could be looked at. But all these are fairly doable, provided we get the policy framework and reduce the uncertainties in the sector. That's all.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Following five articulate speakers is a tough challenge, so I'll strive to be brief, also to leave some time for questions. What I'd like to do is give a little bit of perspective of the global landscape in the financing of infrastructure and how the piece of the India puzzle fits in and some of the opportunities and challenges that underlie it. We've actually seen, as a consequence of what transpired in financial markets in 06, 07, 08, a very substantial and, in fact, continuing to evolve landscape in the financing of project and infrastructure finance. Banks historically, internationally, have funded the vast majority of particularly greenfield infrastructure and project finance spend. And we're seeing, by way of some of the challenges in the landscape, banks increasingly becoming capital constrained as it relates particularly to this endeavor. The key reasons really being the stress right now on the European banking system, and they have historically been some of the biggest providers of loan capital. The emergence of Basel III, which banks are struggling with as to the implications. And how does this all tie into the challenges and the opportunities around India? Let me start first with the challenges. I really look at this, and we look at this as a global competition for capital dynamic, because the investment needs globally for infrastructure spend and the build-out of the power and energy sectors in different regions and economies is substantial. Just to give you some of the numbers, India itself has $1 trillion in its next five-year plan by way of investment needs. If you look at the numbers in Latin America, $114 billion a year over the next 10 years. The European Commission has quantified the spend required for infrastructure and power in the EU at 1.5 to 2 trillion euros over the next 10 years. The estimates, or I would call them more guesstimates, as to the investment in alternative energy sources here in the U.S. range anywhere over the next 10 years range anywhere from $500 million to pick your number. How is all this going to get financed? The competition for capital dynamic comes very much into play in terms of where and how capital internationally and globally gets allocated to infrastructure and project priorities in different economies. In terms of also some of the further challenges, and this alludes to some of the commentary made in terms of the specialization of the credit function, both the Secretary and others have alluded to, that model started to evolve by way of the monoline insurance globally. And with the demise of the monoline insurers, or the insurers that essentially take very complicated risks and provide their guarantee on them so they can be sold as more simple AAA bonds, the demise of those institutions in 2007, 2008 essentially eliminated that source of credit intermediation globally. And so going forward, the financial community will struggle to find a new specialized, if you will, industry to intermediate the credit in project infrastructure and finance. And for now, it remains the banks, with the opportunity being capital markets. And that really brings us to the opportunities, and particularly related to India. If one looks at where the deepest investor pockets lie for debt financing, whether simple or whether complicated, it is by far the institutional investor fixed income markets globally, and particularly in this country when it comes to things that are more involved or complexity, number one. Number two, it is striking to me how small a percentage of Indian exposure portfolio managers have on a senior debt levels relative to other countries. If one takes as a proxy what we call emerging market indices, or indices of debt funds that invest in bonds from emerging market regions, India is actually a comparatively low percentage of any index. Given the opportunity in India by way of the fundamentals economically, given the scale of the opportunity by way of earning returns from the infrastructure spend that needs to take place in that country, the opportunity to rebalance those indices, to rebalance the portfolio holdings of India-related exposure strikes me as being a very significant one, number one. And number two, it is uniquely aligned with the nature of infrastructure spending, because that is long-duration money, or that's money that's invested for the long term, and infrastructure, by their nature, are very long-term assets. Reconciling these competing objectives and constraints is really the job of everybody on this panel, the job of the financial community. The Secretary, I think, very succinctly outlined some of the considerations underlying the instruments that are being explored and implemented by the public sector in India. There's been a very thoughtful process of going through what those issues are, and they're very articulately outlined. In fact, you could almost take the Secretary's speech and put it into a research report by way of what some of the underpinnings of raising debt are. And in implementing that going forward, the next challenge is to unlock the potential pools of capital and bring those to India. But in doing that, the return on capital dynamic and the risk-reward dynamic in terms of what the risk-reward is in going to India versus other countries does come into play.
So Mr. Secretary, I think what we've heard is a wide range of comments here, some contextual about urbanization and the global competition for capital, some about the fundamentals, the basic context, whether it's with regard to municipal structure, and from a U.S. perspective, obviously, we're dealing with very strong municipalities with their own finance raising ability, or whether it deals with regulatory certainty. And then I like the phrase institutional piping. I hope that's not trademarked. we could change some we will attribute it. When you listen to what is a broad range of comments, how does it affect your initial framing? I mean, what do you take as some key priorities coming out of this that you need to take home? What are challenges that might not have been in the initial, at least structural framing? This is what happens when you come to the United States, of course. You have to,
See, the issues which all the panelists have spoken are extremely relevant. I mean, it's not to say that, I mean, any one of that is less, I mean, important. Land acquisition, Mr. Gulab Chand mentioned, I know what's the kind of issues he had to go through on environment regulation. Now, what is required, perhaps, is in some sense a certainty, what I would call it a predictability in how we are handling this. We are making efforts. It's not that, I mean, we are perfect. We are making efforts. For instance, in the coal issue, there's a problem on go, no-go areas. Now we are close to cracking that problem and making it predictable for the persons who are going to invest in the coal sector. So we are attacking sector by sector. Second, the issue relating to the concession agreements being flawed. Well, it is evolving. Not that, I mean, we were able to get those agreements instantaneously. There was an iterative process by which this all went through, and we have developed some of the best documents, but I still concede that much more room exists for improvement, and we constantly do it. It's not that we are going to stop at one point in time. There were issues relating to policy side on what is infrastructure. Yes. Infrastructure has a different definition by different players, and therefore that for a project developer, it becomes a problem for him to really go and say to some institution, he says, no, this is not infrastructure. So this issue we are cracking now. We are maybe in a couple of months, we'll be in a position to get those definitions made uniform so that it is applicable across regulators and financiers. It will be applicable across the sector. We have floated the idea of debt fund, which is in the public domain. It's on the website. We feel that it's not perfect. Nothing is perfect because there are a few issues which we need to tackle in terms of your exposure norms, the size, one can lend vis-a-vis the net owned funds. What's the risk weights you add? Provide for that. How to do the hedging for the foreign exchange? Those kind of issues are still under discussion, and we hope to get that also done through. Now, all I can say is that this is an ongoing process, and this process is something where we would like to contribute is to see that we earnestly and sincerely take this process forward and try and crack problems one by one. I don't assure that the time frame, let's say a 2 months, 3 months, by which I'll be in a position to crack all of them, but we are making very sincere efforts, and those who have participated with us in the structuring of the infrastructure debt fund would know how it has been participative as we went along. And we are sure we are going to do the same process for.
Well, thank you very much for those responses. I was just wondering, I thought Aaron's framing at the beginning was really quite interesting in terms of the right conceptual approach to financing infrastructure, and particularly the focus on the interplay between the old and the retrofit and the new build, and wherein lies the greatest return on investment, particularly given externalities and other effects, and the power of network thinking and network implementation, where the interplay of road and transport and energy and various innovation build out are thought of in unison. The U.S. has struggled with this, obviously, because we've tended to compartmentalize much of our investments. And literally, we can take you to any city or metropolitan area and show you the disconnect. So I was just wondering how the other panelists might respond to some of that conceptual approach and how that aggravates, perhaps, or exacerbates the infrastructure challenge. It almost requires sort of an urban policy as a sort of a broader framing for some of these particular infrastructure investments. Any comments on that?
I can offer a couple of comments. I think, there's the theory, and then there is the practice.
Therein lies the chasm.
Therein lies the chasm. And I think that if I were to, I've seen this as very close quarters, we are not. The challenge is not even to try and make second-best decisions, but we are down to making third, fourth-best policy choices. But that's just the nature of the world. It's extremely untidy. There's a tendency, I think we have to guard against a tendency that might lead us down the path of making the perfect the enemy of the good, or not so bad, actually. Coming back to the question of framing the scale and the context for design of infrastructure. You're right. I mean, ideally, you'd want to have as wide a canvas as possible so that you could plan for and design for intermodal connectivity and so on. But just like the United States, our structure of governance and government doesn't make it easy because you have the federal government, you have the state government, you have the urban local bodies, and there are all kinds of different competing interests that are involved, which makes it very, very hard. That said, I think that there's an interesting tension today between the logic of a certain political narrative and debate, which is to empower all the way down to the urban local body, right? Which is fine. But the reality is that the capacity sits at the level of the province or the state, right? And I think that we should not, my personal opinion, we shouldn't be seduced by the logic of decentralization and throw the baby out with the bathwater. There is very important skills sets that reside in urban planning bodies that look at these things statewide. And we have to find a way of harnessing those skills and marrying that with decentralization of decision making at the urban local body. It's too complicated to sort of debate here, but that's sort of the challenge that we face.
But I think what's interesting about this conversation is you're marrying sort of the technical, the financial unlocking conversation, right? The institutional piping with some of these broader structural issues. I mean, and in the U.S., I think, frankly, even as we talk about these special purpose vehicles or these special finance institutions to leverage up private capital, what we're still missing is the network effect and the broader sort of vision of sustainable growth. So, question, Gene.
I think one of the points that I found important that Aaron made was he talked about not just the user of the infrastructure as the beneficiary, because there are beneficiaries outside that. For example, when you build a bridge across something, you are actually benefiting hotels, restaurants, on either side of the bridge, who do not actually contribute, and that's what creates the viability gap. So it's not really viability, but because these other beneficiaries do not contribute. So in some cases, they have found answers by making access to a road dependent upon that particular community paying for that access. So there are some innovative ways that could be thought of, but I think India could learn from this that there is a beneficiary more than just the user that also needs to be captured in making a payment towards making that infrastructure.
Aaron, I know you provided a conceptual frame, and we're going to open up to questions. And I, whoever is out there really running the timing of this, you have to tell us when the hard stop is. So maybe 10 minutes, we're okay, we're good. It's an eternity in America. When you think about what the U.S. can really teach India, given that we're struggling with an infrastructure deficit that we can't finance and we can't seem to find the right vehicles, what's working here that might translate across borders? Is it our municipal financing system?
So I think to fill in the numbers from Nasser's point, the American Society of Civil Engineers puts our infrastructure deficit at $2.2 trillion here in the States. That's, people can have different estimates, but that's probably the one most widely cited. So you're right. Your framework that you put in is right. It's a global challenge, and these are large amounts of money and large amounts of capital. And Bruce, your question is difficult because we are competing for these funds globally. We have a unique and highly fragmented and siloed structure that we're trying to advance from. And we're trying, I think, to look for the market as a driving force to capture and force some of this value capture that you reference back into projects? Because if it does exist, and we know it exists, and there are multiple studies out there that show, then it's simply a question of coordination efforts at the jurisdictional level, at the multi-jurisdictional level, thinking about it not just in terms of networks, but also in terms of corridors. And we're trying to focus that. One of the ideas that came up was somewhat tangentially related to what you point out, is one of our states, in addition to looking at toll revenue, looked at privatizing or doing a P3 in terms of the rest facilities as an area that generates growth on a highway and a road, and that's a different area than just simply dealing with tolls. There's a lot of value capture, a lot of partnering with construction, both on greenfield but also in maintenance and brownfield in terms of infill development and other areas. I think often people tend to look towards the next infrastructure investment and towards greenfields only, and not looking back into how can we go back, extract new value due to improving existing infrastructure as a way to catalyze investment. But I think ultimately moving towards more market-based financing mechanisms will be a very valuable way to do that, because the market itself will generate that pressure that heretofore hasn't existed to go out and create those kind of more innovative financing spaces to allow other beneficiaries to help fund the infrastructure who aren't just users.
Let me open up for questions, because right back here. Oh. We've got mics.
Hi, I'm Mark Reedy with the law firm Vince Levin. I'd like to applaud what the Secretary is doing with credit-enhanced bonds. I'd like to point to a program that you should follow at the Department of Agriculture in the United States. We put together a bond program that is credit enhanced with loan guarantees, which would enable us to get about 2% below the commercial lending rate and 25 years on the bonds. So it would help amortize a greenfield project. These projects are $250 million senior debt. We're using bonds for 100% of the senior debt, replacing them with the institutional investor market, which is a multi-trillion dollar market in the U.S., which is virtually untapped. And it's something that you could use there in India if the government stepped out and did this. Now, USDA is underwriting the technology risk also. So an EPC doesn't have to put up a performance bond or a technology wrap on a new technology. Now, these have been done with integrated biorefineries and biopower projects, so it's a very specific program. But it could be done wherever you can get a credit enhancement, and a loan guarantee is a very good credit enhancement. In this case, the project company bonds are not investment grade, and once you put the full faith and credit of the U.S. government with the loan guarantee over the top, they become AAA rated paper, and the institutional market will buy it in a blink. So it's a good starting block, which you're at now. I think you could refine it by looking at what we've done with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It took us 2 years to rewrite the loan guarantee programs to make this work. It will work with other credit enhancement, but we found that the insurance companies will not go out, at least so far we've seen, the 25 years on coverage. So 20 to 25 years, and you need a long amortization period on some of these projects. The other thing I'd throw out as a question, I know it used to be, and this goes to what Rajiv Lal was saying about the use of OPIC, it used to be that the Reserve Bank of India had a restriction where a foreign person brought a cent couldn't guarantee the obligations of an Indian person brought a cent, which would prohibit you from being able to use a loan guarantee from IFC or OPIC or Ex-Im Bank to be able to do that. Now, if you could get the Reserve Bank to take that restriction out, you could virtually open up a tremendous new alternative for financing your projects in addition to commercial loans.
Comments?
These are very good suggestions. We've had a lot of debate, continuing debate in India, whether or not the government should be in the business of guaranteeing in any way, shape, or form private sector debt. I can't I don't think there's any definitive answer on that. But on your point about restrictions that RBI applies on foreign entities guaranteeing domestic is something that I will take up with the RBI. Yes.
Bruce, could I comment on the just very briefly on the loan guarantee programs, because it's a very fascinating topic. One of the largest transactions ever financed through a loan guarantee program was the largest wind farm in the world last year, $2.2 billion project, wind energy, Greenfield, Columbia River Valley. Caithness Shepherd's Flat was the name of the project, something I'm very intimately familiar with. It had a loan guarantee program that involved multiple creditor classes. And on one hand, it was a roaring success in bridging disconnects in the market when this project started out in a time when those disconnects were very big. On the other hand, my observation, I choose my words delicately here, is are governments really the best parties to be in the position of being a credit intermediary? And I just leave that question out there because I think there's a lot to be learned from that experience as to how to take the successes in that story and meld them with perhaps more efficient ways of credit intermediation.
Very helpful.
Yeah, I'd also add the importance on any loan guarantee to getting the scoring from a government standpoint accurate so that you're collecting in revenue proportionate to your risk as a government perspective to not leave an unfunded potential liability on the government's
right.
balance sheet.
Right. But, yeah. I mean, that said, I want to say that guarantee program was a huge success in this particular case. But I think, to the speaker's point, there's a lot that can be learned from loan guarantee programs, both good and bad, and how to implement them optimally. And it's a learning process as we go along.
So we're being told that we are out of time. And I think actually that's a great way to end this because it ends on a comment around clean energy finance, which, as we talk about infrastructure in India, infrastructure in the U.S., whatever we think it was 5 years ago, think out 10, 15, 20 years and the possibility of technologically enabled infrastructure that begins to radically reduce energy costs. This has been a great panel. I am sorry that we're out of time, but thank you all for listening.